Hi, welcome to the Apple Lab Podcast, episode number 146. Mr. Ford Pier, before we get started, I want to let you know that this episode is brought to you in part by Bose All Natural Brewing. Check out their Lug Tread. It's crisp, balanced, and refreshing. It's a lagered ale. It's a term they coined. It's fermented like an ale and cold aged like a lager. And when I say that, it feels like I know what I'm talking about, but I really don't. You know what I do know? It's delicious beers. Delicious, delicious. And they actually sent me a few other little brands. They sent me the Kissmeyer Nordic Pale Ale, which is absolutely delicious. My favorite of the three actually is Wag the Wolf. It's part of the Wild Oats series. Also, check out the Tom Green Cherry Milk Stout. It's also really good. It gives you sticky lips, though. But you can also check out their full-time IPA. It's their newest full-time brand. That's how they got the name. It is delicious, too. I mean, they're really good at making IPAs. That's what I do know. Okay. So pick up Bose anywhere beer is sold. Check out their website, bose.ca, for more great products and great details all about Bose. Yum, yum, yum beer. Amazon shoppers, why don't you go to applelock.ca/Amazon or applelock.ca/US Amazon, and you'll be redirected to Amazon, where you can support the show by shopping on Amazon. I said Amazon 1,000 times. Go to applelock.ca if you want to do it the old-fashioned way and click on those links on the right side. Don't forget to bookmark it, okay? So when you bookmark it, you go back to that bookmark and you're still supporting the show and it costs you no extra money. If you want to help the show out on a monthly basis, you can go to patreon.com/applelock and pledge as much or as little as you want on a monthly basis to help with hosting and gas fees. You can cancel anytime. And what I am doing is I'm saving up for a special trip. So all the money that's going in from patrons are coming into a special bank account, and I'm saving enough money where I could probably maybe even get on a plane and fly somewhere and actually do a podcast with somebody who doesn't like to, apparently doesn't like to return emails. Ha ha. You can buy a t-shirt and buy some music. My band's Foursquare's discography for $20 by going to applelock.ca/shop. You can subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. Give it 5 stars. It really helps that show out where it's ranked in the scheme of things, because that's what we're all about, being ranked. You can like the show on Facebook by going to facebook.com/applelockpod and follow me on Twitter at simonhead666. Aha, under 2 minutes and 30 seconds. What do you think about that? That's fast, right? Because some people sometimes say I talk too much at the start. But you know what? I actually don't. Some people do podcasts and they talk about their lives. I don't really like to do that. It's not my thing. But I just talked about my life. Oh, okay. I should probably edit that part out. Today on the show, I have Mr. Ford Pier. Ford Pier and I have kind of been acquaintances, I'd say, for the past 25 years. Ford is very good friends with a few friends of mine out of the band SNFU, and that's how we kind of met, is through that recording session in the mid-90s, I'd say around the early to mid-90s, where we're doing backup vocals on a song off the SNFU album, Fulaba, and I don't even think they kept it. But regardless, he's been a backup guy for the Real Statics, another one of my favorite bands of all time. So here he is, Mr. Ford Pier, on the Applelock Podcast. Guess you were involved with that whole Edmonton punk rock scene, right? Like in the early days.
I was there. I wasn't a person that made things happen in it, but I was a witness. Mm-hmm. I was a participant. Yep, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Edmonton's kind of a weird small town, but it's also big enough that, you know, there's still a scene. You know, there always was a scene. And were you like the skateboarder kid, or what kind of kid were you?
No, I wasn't a skater at all.
Yeah.
I kind of came to the punk scene like sort of by my own paths of inquiry. It wasn't an interest that I shared with any of my friends. Actually, that's not true. There were a couple of kids in junior high who were curious and who had like records by the Sex Pistols and the Specials and stuff like that. But I went to my first couple of gigs by myself. And this is something that I always have to bring up in discussions about Edmonton and growing up in the punk and hardcore scene in Edmonton. It was so good. It was such a gift. And anybody who was there will tell you so. Reason being that there weren't enough people to have a particular kind of show for a long time. So if there was going to be a show, then it was going to be Jerry and the Sons of Rhythm Orchestra and Entirely Distorted and Euthanasia or War Toys or something. There would be like a bill made up of four or five entirely different bands. And that was going to be the show.
Yeah.
Because it changed a little bit later on, but when I first started going to see groups, I was exposed to a lot of different kinds of music in that setting, just because there's only a couple of people who are into it. If we're going to wait around for there to be like enough people who are only interested in going and seeing bands that like pattern themselves after Killing Joke or whatever, then we're going to have a very long wait. Or all hardcore shows. Those didn't happen for a little while.
Yeah, Calgary had the same idea. There was it didn't matter. Yeah. It was a show that everybody could kind of hang out because it seemed so small that it didn't matter if you're kind of a metaler or if you're into punk rock or if you're into ska or whatever. There was a big coming together to have, you know. I mean, that's super healthy, especially like in an early scene where it can become, you know, I like my music, I like your music, and then we can all kind of be a scene together. I mean, that's a romantic way of looking at what it used to be like, but I'm sure there was probably some like turmoil when it came to like crossover like genres and stuff like that.
Yeah, all of that stuff sort of eventually reared its head, but you know, like when you're young, or that young anyway, it's like the amount of time that passes before those sorts of things start to be considerations. That's like, you know, a tenth of your life has gone by when it wasn't a problem, you know? So it just seems like this enormous halcyon period where everybody just kind of got along and was into each other's stuff. And nobody really listened to that stuff all that much anyhow. They listened to new releases or whatever, but really, they would, you know, like the older guys that I got to know a little bit, when they would go driving around in their van or whatever, they would all be listening to like Warren Zevon. Or, you know, it really didn't, at that point, it really didn't matter what anybody was, what sort of music anybody made. I see some of that with some of the younger people that I know in Vancouver nowadays.
Okay, yeah.
Just like, you know, like here I am in a doom metal band. Oh, yeah, and here's my roommate who plays in this twee pop synth thing or whatever, and really all that we do is hang around and drink box wine and listen to Neil Young.
I was gonna say, I mean, that was gonna be a question, like do you find that sort of you've taken that sort of I guess want to call it an ethic, you take that ethic into later on in life to say I appreciate music and I appreciate music for what it is and I love music because it's that, like, or like, how do you take it all that?
Yeah. There's the eclecticism of it with the Edmonton scene, and also the years that I spent at the university radio station there when I was still, you know, very young.
Yeah.
Before I was at of university age or whatever, just sort of imbued a sense that, you know, like anything good is good. And, you know, aligning yourself with a group of people who were, it seems, I think that most people think this way nowadays, and it's crazy to think that throughout the 1980s you could get like beat up for listening to a different kind of music, but you could, you know. Definitely that sort of pantheistic approach to, you know, like all different kinds of music. That was huge for me.
Yeah, yeah. So your first kind of bands, what was your first sort of Edmonton band experience?
The first real band that I was in was a band called God, which was a previously existing group of some guys who were a little older than me. They were my favorite band in Edmonton, and they had a little bit of a lineup shakeup, and somehow I got asked to, you know, like whether I would like going to go and jam with them. And I wound up in that group for, I don't know, that was my life from the last year of high school. I don't know, 2 years, 3 years, something like that. We did one very brief tour of Western Canada, and it just, not a great deal happened with it outside of Edmonton, but it was enough for me to decide, yeah, I like this.
Yeah,
I
want
to do more.
What era? What year was this about?
Late 80s.
Yeah. So that's sort of the beginning of the Smalls? Is that sort of that era?
It was a little bit before the Smalls, as a matter of fact. I remember the Smalls' first show because that was, they were, a couple of them anyway, were music students at Grant McEwen when it was Grant McEwen Community College. And their first show, I'm pretty sure it might have been their second show, but I'm going to say that it was their first show. And it was opening up for the band that I was roadieing for, whom I later wound up joining, which was Junior Gone Wild.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
This
yeah.
would have been that was in 1989.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I remember there was a time in the sort of the late 80s that there was the Smalls and there was, what was that band down in Calgary that John was in, John Hibbert's band?
Never Dull Moment or Field Day?
Field Day yeah. with Jonas playing bass. And then there was sort of like the solo, like, and then Winnipeg, there was Red Fisher. And there was sort of like this power poppy kind of like.
Now you had some association with Red Fisher. Is that correct?
Yeah, I joined them in like 19.
Were you in that band?
Yeah, I was in about 1992 to around 93 and a bit. Maybe 94.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I did two tours and played bass in Red Fisher, and that was a very eye-opening, amazing experience at how different people are between the West and the East Coast.
Sure. Okay, yeah.
Very different. You know, prairie people are very laid-back people. I mean, and Toronto people aren't. And, you know, I'm a different person now, but I think I could be in Red Fisher now. But back then, I was probably the annoying Toronto kid, you know, like, let's make it. You know? We're gonna make it.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that was always the there was always that sort of bigotry from the West, which once I started spending more time in Toronto, and I don't know, maybe Toronto had kind of changed its spots by that time, but you know, there was always sort of a prejudice against Toronto as being, you know, like comparatively soulless and very careerist and cold in its motivations and you know, like very sceney and cliquey and everything.
Yeah.
I responded to it that way when I first started spending time there, which was wrong of me. I probably cut myself out of a lot of pleasant experiences because once I became like fast friends with all of the Rio Statics people, for instance, and via groups like who all did Junior play with for a while there, Pig Farm, Dinner Is Ruined,
Change of Heart,
those guys, all that gang of people, like over down at the Bev there, everybody get along, of course.
Yeah,
but you know, we didn't think that there were any good Toronto bands except for our personal friends, and then. You know, like once I started, well, basically living out there, or before that even, I just sort of realized that I had, you know, had the wrong idea about the place, and that it was really much more, you know, Catholic, and it was much more like the sort of thing that I was talking about before, where, you know, like anything that's good is good, and people who are committed to doing something, anything, have at least that much in common and can sit down and have a beer together and can find something to appreciate in each other's creative output.
Yeah, you know, and I think it can be, the credit is where credit is due, where you deal with West Coast, where people are West Coast and Edmonton and Calgary is somehow lumped in there, and Winnipeg is sort of even somehow lumped in there, is that guys like me from Toronto would see people from the West Coast and see how they operate and went, huh, okay, this is a whole different way to, you know, to deal with the love of music, you know, and it's opened my eyes when I met people from the West Coast that sort of had a different approach, and they were very, you know, enthusiastic to play music, but the whole making it part wasn't really like a big issue.
You want to know what one of the most salient differences between drummers in Toronto and drummers in the West is? Mm-hmm. An extra rack tom. I believe that it's because, like, everybody that I used to play with, like, up until, I don't know, up until the millennium, everybody had like two rack toms and the floor tom and et cetera, et cetera. But I believe that any impulse to have more than rack, floor, end of story is squelched in a young drummer growing up in Ontario, because there will always be some twat who will go, "Oh, who do you think you are? Neil Peart."
Well, I don't know.
That shout out doesn't loom quite as long over the efforts of aspiring musicians in the Prairie provinces.
Well, I don't know. Dave Reese had two rack toms because I set them up every single night on a tour.
Exactly.
You see, there you go. Oh, yeah, he's from Montreal, isn't he? There you go.
Dave? No, he's from Edmonton.
Well, but he lived in Montreal for a while to play.
He went to Montreal, but he was one of the first, like, it's hilarious, you know, Dave is probably like a year older than me or something, but he was like in a band.
Yeah.
In the first year that I was in high school, he was in a group called Entirely Distorted.
Yeah.
And I went to high school with one of those guys, and meeting those guys to me was like, I am actually talking with somebody who's in a band. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, so because he did this weird show in Montreal, being like Gigi Allen's like backup band, and I think did he ever tell you that story?
What, in Montreal?
Yeah,
Montreal.
The
wilderness years when he was out there with Broken Smile, he joined My Dog Popper too, right?
Yeah. But Broken Smile was the backup band, I believe, for Gigi Allen when he couldn't get the band into Canada, so it just him, like, somehow got into Canada and did the whole thing, like the whole shtick.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, right?
How can it be that I never heard that story? Oh, well.
No, he told, well, I spent a lot of van time with Mr. Dave Reese.
Yeah. No doubt.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, Junior Gone Wild, how many times you make it out to Toronto? Like, at all? Like, a few times, right?
Many, many times.
Yeah.
We were in Toronto a lot, and we had a manager who lived there. And so when we would go off on, you know, like a 6-week Cross Canada tour, which we would do, you know, a couple of times a year, three times a year, we would be in Toronto for a lot of that, just sort of staying in different places around the city and doing like little short hops to like go and play at York University or dash down to St. Catharines or go to like Merrifield or Kitchener Waterloo or whatever, but the base of operations for weeks at a time would be Toronto. So got to know the place pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. Who
and didn't embrace it.
Sorry, what?
Didn't embrace it though, owing to bigotries, which I mentioned earlier.
I remember Jason Tate said from Weaker Than was Red Fisher as well. He said in an interview from Much West with Jay Myers and said that he can get all the same Miles Davis records in Winnipeg that he can in Toronto. And then he later confided in me and said, "I was full of shit. It's way better shit in Toronto." Yeah. He said, "Yeah, no, the Toronto's got everything and it's awesome." And he lived here for, you know, in Toronto for quite a while.
Oh yeah, a good long time. And he loved it too. But it was just like they have a house now. That wasn't going to happen anytime soon in Toronto.
No, absolutely not. No, I live about an hour and a half. I can't live in Toronto. And plus, we have kids. I don't want to live in Toronto. I think living somewhat in the country is a bit more enticing.
Where is it that you guys are?
We're about an hour and a half outside of Toronto in a town called Uxbridge, just north of a town called Pickering. I don't know if you know where Pickering is, but...
Yes. I sure do.
But 30 minutes north of that. So
I know where you're talking about. That's situated pretty good.
Yeah.
And it's not too much of a pain, like for work or whatever.
No, it's like 35 minutes to the theater I work at. And I do
like... Well, you have a regular gig like in Pickering?
Well, it's in Richmond Hill, which is about 35 minutes from here. Yeah, no, it's the closest job I've ever had to my house, like ever, you know, like... You know, usually it's, I worked at York University for over 10 years.
Yeah.
That job went away a couple of years ago, and now I'm here, but yeah.
Oh, actually, I knew that. Actually, and I think that the reason why I knew that is I had known it before for some reason, but it was, I was reminded of it when I was listening to your interview that you did here with Mike Phillip.
Michael Phillip, yes.
And that came up in that.
A gentleman and a scholar, Michael Phillip.
That's a fact.
Absolutely. Yeah, what a star. I mean, yeah, he really shaped, like, sounds like for the Real Statics and mm-hmm. early Bare Naked Ladies, and like he is definitely a force, and it's just, you know, like a statesman of you know, Ontario or Toronto music. You know, he's great.
Yeah, his musicality is just a marvelous thing, and also I love spending time with him so much. We have a lot of interests in common. We've worked on a number of records together. He did a couple of mine, and we did a record with that we were both very proud of, with John Mann from Spirit of the West. Hmm. John and Spirit were like on a, well, it turned out to be a break. I think that they were treating it as being like a break up at the time. John wanted to play music which was a little bit more in the vein of the contemporary pop of the first years of the young millennium, and he and Michael and I and Doug Elliott from The Odds made this record, which of these like really great pop songs, which, yeah, we came away from that being very proud. And that was Mike and I's first time feeling each other out in the studio, getting used to each other's workflow and rhythms and needs and everything. And, mm-hmm. you know, am I able to, you know, equivocate with humor with this guy, or is he going to stay on? And so, yeah, we figured out that we would be able to work together on a record of mine, and we did that over the next couple of years, and that turned out well. Mm-hmm. So I love working with him.
Yeah, when you make records, is it you all strictly doing like most things? Because I know you play pretty much everything, right?
No, I only did that once. Yeah. I only did that for my first record, just to like sort of say, "Ha ha, mm-hmm. I can do this."
Yeah,
which was, you know, quixotic, mixed results. But, you know, I did it. And then there was the Cast of Thousands approach for a few years, like particularly the one that the big one that Mike produced. And for the last couple of records have been with the band that I've, the stable lineup that I've had ever since that I moved back to Vancouver.
Right.
Who were two of my oldest friends, and we worked together very well. So mm-hmm. that's an easy thing to do.
It's kind of fun playing in a band, right? Like, you know, I've been in the same vein where I could play everything, and you get that proud moment, like I could do all this, but you miss hanging out, like most of the mm-hmm. hanging out part and bouncing off people that, and it's exactly playing your own music, all the instruments, it misses out. It's what it is today is like, I could just make it and fix it in the computer and, you know, make a rep,
oh yeah,
you know?
I hate that shit. The engineers that I work with, I'm always, or I, well, they do their own thing. I have no agency because they know how everything works and I don't. But the instruction is always to, you know, to be destructive with things, not to keep things that we reject. It's like, I'm doing it again because that one definitely wasn't something that we're going to use. So we're going to go over it. We're going to treat it like a track on some tape.
Yeah.
Sometimes they do that and sometimes they don't. Generally they don't, because they know that there's going to be something that we hope that we can, you know, like a note that there's a better version of lying underneath, and they'll be able to save themselves some work down the line.
Well, that's, you know, the problem now. They can capture it all, right?
Yeah. And I think that that has aesthetic ramifications. I think that you wind up in a situation now where there's a lot of music, which, you know, 10 years ago, there was music which wouldn't have been possible without that embarrassment of choice, right? And people's tastes have been shaped by exposure to that kind of music. So now they write to that, they create to that, and it's music which is impossible to make without, you know, like you can't be inspired to make music like that. So it's missing a little something. You can always tell when that's where it's coming from, right?
Yeah, I think it takes a steady some perception to say, like, okay, I've done 1,000 takes of this one song, and I'm gonna find the 1,000 best parts in these 1,000 takes. Like, that's impossible, you know. And what felt good back in the old 2-inch tape days, or even committing to the recording, that's the part there's the bad part where you go like, oh, I guess that's good enough, you know. And then there's the part where I love the way that feels, and that's the part we're missing, I think, today with recorded music.
Well, somebody else whom I learned loads from about, you know, using the studio and embracing your mistakes was, of course, John from No Means No.
Wow. Yeah. Who
I remember the first time that I recorded with him was just doing a couple of little things on a Show Business Giants record before I was actually in the band, which was a band with me and Tom and John from No Means No, and Scott Henderson, and just about anybody else who happened to live in Victoria at that time. And there was a kick hit that he wasn't happy with. It was kind of fluffy, and so he decided to embrace it, and this is a profile, and he went on out onto the floor and roll tape, and just where the bad hit was, he took like the cushion from a drum stool, and he hit his chest with it. So that was, so that produced like a flam. It made it seem intentional. It drew attention to the mistake and produced something in a studio environment which wouldn't have happened otherwise, which what I came to understand about little things like that is that those are the little treats. That's the secret energy of a recording, which stands in for the energy that you get from a live performance. Because I strongly disagree with the we'll play it properly, and if the sounds are good, we'll capture it and we'll have an awesome record. That simply isn't true. There's pneumos which occurs when you're in the room with that happening, which doesn't, it can't be recorded. It doesn't transmit from a performance which has already happened. So many of the great conductors in the earliest days of recording just thought, this is a gimmick. This is never gonna, you know, like they didn't take it seriously. And, you know, I've read old interviews with a lot of them, which is like, why would anybody listen to music which has already happened? The point is to be listening to it while it's, you know, like, ah, whatever, you guys do whatever you want. I'm gonna have a cigarette, they would say.
Yeah.
And I think that what they're referring to there is, yeah, there is a deficit of a particular kind of energy, but you can make up for that by making a recording, which doesn't have to be a like woohoo, like XTC's Oranges and Lemons crazy recording.
Yeah.
It can just be, you know, little things like drawing attention to a mistake with another mistake to make it seem as though, like, wow, how'd they think of that?
Yeah. I think we're heading in a direction where we're supposed to be getting smarter as we get more evolved. But I think what we need to do as humans is start understanding that hidden nuance that is recording, that when you hear a special moment, you're like, oh, I like that moment. And then you might not hear it the next time around. You might hear something else. And if someone mm-hmm. can engineer that into a production where they're gushing out these emotions out of you and you have no idea that it's happening, that's, you know what I mean? That's where we're heading, hopefully, I hope, you know, where I can listen to a record three different ways and go, oh, this is so cool, you know, or, you know, and also in that part about just live music is supposed to be played or music is supposed to be played by musicians live. Well, we're not going to, sometimes you can't get that, but we're in a direction where we possibly could try to make that happen somehow, you know, whether we can fake it in a way, and fake it's a bad word, it's a bad choice, but it's, you know what I'm trying to get at, right? Where
I do. And I think that that goes for music, which isn't supposed to be played by I think that that goes for music, which isn't meant to be played by musicians. There's, mm-hmm. you know, like a lot of electronic music, sort of the point is that it doesn't have any tether to any sort of a human, you know, like there's these records that arrive at the store that I work at in these plain black sleeves. And it's such a pain in the ass to figure out, okay, well, what is this? Who ordered this? How much is it supposed to cost? How do I tell it apart from this other one? But you listen to it, of course. And it seems to me as though the semiotic purpose of a lot of that music is to create something which transcends the personality or character of a human, which is not an ignoble purpose. You know, I mean, like, is there a whole lot of nature or wildlife out where you live?
Not really.
No. Okay. Well, I don't know. I mean, like, we every day I look out my window and I see these mountains and this ocean, which I never really make any use of or anything, but they, you know, we have it within ourselves to be moved by things which are beyond behavior or which are beyond language. And I think that some electronic music which would be totally impossible without all sorts of gizmos or whatever, ironically aspires to that condition to a greater extent than does a whole lot of classical music, which relies upon skill, mm-hmm. Jazz music, which relies upon interaction between humans, songwriting in the folk, pop, rock tradition, any of the multifarious permutations of that sort of writing, which relies upon a fusion of tonality and language to make any sort of a point. There is music which can just sort of be sound.
Yeah. You know, they've made a computer to be able to beat you at chess, so that's just the next evolution, right? Where a computer could define an algorithm that makes people pee their pants or makes people think a different color or think. I mean, they're working on that stuff, you know? I mean, like, and it does happen. And, you know, think about 500 years from now where all it is these weird tones and there's no actual real structure, but they've used these tones to create like this resonance in your brain that makes you think a certain way. I mean, that's what happens. I mean, like, they make a tone that makes people poop their pants, and when they're protesting, I mean, like, we're
nobody's ever really been able to get a hang on that.
I don't know, right?
I mean, like, you know, if Throbbing Gristle couldn't harness that technology, then, you know, and I think that they put an awful lot of effort into that.
Yeah, but, yeah, they did.
It may as well be called the Sasquatch tone, because I don't think that very many people have ever actually been like in the same room with this tone.
Yeah.
Well, you hear about it.
I've been on a dark German highway listening to Slayer, Rain and Blood, and it makes me feel so many several thoughts. It makes me drive very fast. I mean, that's just metal music. That's just Slayer. So imagine 500 years from now what we can actually achieve when Slayer is long gone.
That's what we're waiting for. We just need Slayer to get out of the fucking way.
That's right.
Then we can achieve anything.
So, I mean, that was a fun little. We went off on a little digression. That was fun. You've done so much music. I mean, like, you're full of music. You've do you just do you look back on stuff? Like, how do you feel about what, you know, it sounds like you're pretty positive about where music's going or where it's come from and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you feel like, you know, does it help you write songs? Does it help you feel better in life? Like, some people don't.
About music?
Just about, yeah, how their life goes and how music is and, you know.
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting question. It's a little like being asked, you know, how do your hands make you feel? You know?
Yeah.
Music is everything to me, and it always has been. I grew up in a musical house. I've always been like totally into the music that I was into. I wouldn't know where to begin to evaluate the effect that proximity to music has had on the course that my life has taken. So I think, yeah, probably music does give me a certain amount of optimism about the future, but in the same measure, to the extent that I am pessimistic about the future, well, that probably has something to do with music too.
Mm-hmm.
And the lasagna that my wife made last night and that I had for lunch this afternoon, well, I was probably tasting that with a little bit of music, you know?
Yeah.
It's everywhere. It's like, you know, working in a chemical plant or something. It's completely taken over all of the atoms in my body.
Do you, I mean, could you imagine a world like where it got taken away from you or your hands couldn't work or your brain doesn't work properly? Like I can't, I mean.
What, where there was no more music?
Well, just your music, where it just all of a sudden, like something in life told you to say, oh, you can't play music anymore. Go do something else. Or have you ever come to the point in your life where you're like, I'm just not going to do this anymore? I mean, like, there's a lot of emotional attachment to music. And when you make something and you feel that it's the most important thing ever, that obviously there's whatever, a certain amount of people in society that are like, I hate this, or I don't like this, or there's the business part of it. And there's all these things that all sort of amalgamate together that become.
Oh yeah. But now we're talking about something else. Now we're talking about that. I mean, like, my relationship with music has very, very little to do with any sort of a practical, temporal concern about, you know, like how much I'm going to get paid or how much I have to produce or anything like that. As a matter of fact, yeah, that I've never got a handle on any of that stuff. I'm really, really bad at it. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you have some appreciation of how long I've been doing this or whatever. I've never been able to make it work for me. I'm no good with money. I put out a prog record and then I tour for a year with a country singer. You know, I mean, like, I have done that sort of thing. That's not an exaggeration. I did that shit. But not being able to do it professionally, sure. My whole adult life has been a sawtooth wave of like, okay, well, now I'm a professional musician and I'm traveling all the time. I'm not making a whole ton of money, but I am paying my way as a musician. Like, I'm sick and tired of placing all this responsibility on music to, you know, like, keep a roof over my head and to keep me fed and everything. I'm going to take a job at a car wash or at a record store or whatever. And then, I'm going crazy. I need to, you know, like, be able to spend more time on playing music for people, and I need to quit and I need to commit myself to it. So I've done that a bunch of times, although over the last several years, I've pretty well leveled out into a, you know, regular domestic existence in Vancouver, where I don't spend as much time on the road as I used to.
Well, you kind of have to. As we get older, it becomes tougher and tougher to sleep on a wooden floor and, you know, and understand the concept of this is what I do. I mean, it's a young person's game when it comes to touring, but writing songs, you know, like it that's where people start getting better at. You know, that's the thing that bugs me about the music business is that people get better at writing songs and they become better musicians as they get older. But unfortunately, MTV or Much Music says, no, you got to be 14 years old and have spiky hair, you know.
Yeah. To well, become the joke's successful. On them because they no longer exist, those two things.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you know, that's maybe that's what out. The snake ate its own tail, you know, where, you know, and now and optimism prevails where, oh, maybe a good song is a good song. I mean, like, we mm-hmm. all change, like, everybody changes their musical preference, you know, like, I was just listening to something today, like, apparently all the kids' toys are like the kids' toys from the 90s, and it makes perfect sense, because the people in the 90s, who were born sort of like in the 80s, are parents now. So all those, like, My Little Ponies and all those things are now successful again, because the people who are mothers used to play with that shit when they were kids, you know, so it's...
What were the kids' toys in the 90s?
I don't know.
Were they, like... Furbies and things?
Yeah, like the it was My Little Ponies and like, oh. You know, I don't know. I just thought it was interesting, like, the musical trends do the same thing. I mean, we all kind of, you know, music starts, everything's so reactionary when it comes to music, you know.
Yep.
You know.
Yeah. Grass is always greener.
Yeah, well, what was cool,
and
like,
people have,
so what?
You know, like, it's trite to even bring it up, mm-hmm. but it is a fact that people's attention spans have been reduced by the amount of time that we spend with computers. We have a quicker turnover. This is an irony worth pondering, is that 40 years ago, the promotion cycle for a record would be like probably 6 or 7 months. And then within a calendar year of the last release, there would be a new record by whatever artist or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Now you can count on 3 years, 5 years. Sometimes it'll be like 8 years. And then all the interviews will be like, oh no, we never broke up. We just wanted to do other things,
mm-hmm.
or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But people get tired of those things quicker. They're exposed to less from one source, and they go jumping over to another source that much quicker. That's, you know, like I guess it's a byproduct of the atomization of not only music, but also of the places where we can get it, and not only it, but all of our other information, whatever other input we require. And there's just so much to take care of, and you only live so long, so only so many hours in the day. So people tend to, I think that maybe there was a point when people worked on digesting things that much quicker, and now we just sort of do that. It's not a wonderful thing, probably, but that's just the way that it is.
Well, everything, I mean, when the music industry is sort of the dollar dictates everything, and if a band like another Beatles comes out, you're going to see a record out of them every 4 months, and it's going to be 12 songs, you know what I mean? Like, that's what kind of happened when the Beatles came out, and people were learning stuff about how the music business works based on what the Beatles did. And when they put out...
But there will never be another Beatles.
No.
There will never be another Beatles. There won't even be, like, another Jethro Tull. It's because the ecosystem that all the people who are making this stuff really hasn't gotten all that much bigger. It's not as though people have more money to spend on music or whatever. As a matter of fact, they probably have a whole lot less, but there is so much more of it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the band, like that band, like that kid band, that One Direction band, and they had a pretty good run, you know, like they went four years or something, and the Beatles lasted about 5 years, you know. It's there's some comparisons there when it came to a commodity and what people could put out. And the only thing the Beatles did is said, fuck it, we're going to put out Sgt. Pepper's, and that's an amazing album. And
yeah,
suck on that, you know. And we're not touring anymore.
Well, you know, I mean, like this is the conversation that me and all of my know-it-all asshole friends used to have when this also wasn't a trite conversation to have, but just like, can you imagine a world in which the Kinks or the Zombies also didn't have to pay for studio time at Abbey Road, could just go in there anytime they wanted to? And, you know, like it pleases me to think of that alternate timeline.
Yeah.
Because I don't know, I think that, you know, maybe in such a world, in that parallel dimension, they aren't now having to deal with Trump, for instance.
Yeah, that's my app I'm developing that makes, every time you hear that word, it makes bird sounds, like tweet, 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 because I'm trying to erase that voice, that name, that whole era of what we're living in right now, because, you know, I equate it to, you know, I mean, this could be a whole different direction, but I equate it to what Hitler did. And if we remember Hitler for being Hitler, and he did so many evil atrocities, we're on the brink of that right now. Like, this is happening. So what about, we tried the whole let's remember what evil is, and that happened in the mid-40s. But what if we just got rid of all the information that we've known between, whatever, 2016 and 2020? Let's just forget it. Let's just erase the history books, and then we'll start again. And, you know, and it's that whole Simpsons joke, like, what happened in Germany between 1939 and 1945? Well, nothing happened. We're on vacation. You know, like, let's do that. Let's do that. You know, because it's, you know, I don't want to get into the Trump conversation.
I mean, like, I think that we can both agree that, you know, people are stupid, and that, you know, if a vase falls off a shelf onto your head, then you're like, oh man, that's dangerous. I'm going to take all the vases down off all the shelves in my house so that nobody ever has a vase fall on their head again. And then a couple of weeks later, a plant falls off your shelf on your head. Like, whoa, nobody saw that coming. I'm going to take down all the, you know. So if you were a very stupid person and this was happening to you, then this might be like some sort of a corollary condition to people not necessarily being able to predict the shape that the next really destructive or evil thing in our lives is going to be. And you sort of think, well, I'm on guard for that. There's no more vases up there. Never again.
Yeah.
That won't happen anymore. But what if a plant falls on your head? What if your cat jumps on your head? You know, things can still fall on your head.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, but honestly, the fact that, you know, he doesn't understand that Canadians celebrate Thanksgiving on the different days in America.
Is that real, or was that a,
I don't even know anymore. I don't even know what's real anymore, Ford. I don't know. That's scary.
That's the tough part. That's big. That's huge. I mean, like, you know, he can't get people to cooperate, and so most of what he's doing is just these sort of bullshit executive orders, which people will be able to reverse. And you know, there still isn't a wall. There's a lot to be, you know, like, mildly optimistic about all of this. But I think that the lasting damage in the last year that I've seen is just like people don't know what to believe anymore.
It's scary,
and they are just sort of naturally skeptical of everything, even helpful things, even good things.
Yeah. That's
a point.
Obama went through the same thing, only that Obama was trying to do things that were, like, somewhat proactive. He did some pretty evil things, too, when it came to, like, foreign affairs. But at least, you know, because it was a Republican Senate, he couldn't push anything through anyways, really. So he was handcuffed. But the Republicans won't even support a Republican president. So that's where we're at now, you know.
I'm not the first person to say so, but basically there is no president of the United States right now. It seems like to me whatever is happening is being, you know, there's a Congress who are operating very, very slowly, and anything that actually functions in the United States is being taken care of by underpaid civil servants.
Yeah.
So there you go.
And the other fact is that the president of the United States, 45 of them ago was like had wooden teeth, and like, you know, the whole understanding of what a president was, we don't need that anymore. Like, we don't need this figurehead that says, I'm the president, you know, like it's all run by, like you say, civil, you know, underpaid civil servants anyway. So politics will still move. Things will be taken care of, but we don't need that orange face monster.
On different shapes in the future. Yep,
I mean, this could be a benchmark to everyone to say, huh, maybe we don't need a real figurehead.
Who knows? Yeah. You know, all of these things can have, you know, they can have dire consequences, but they can also have glorious results. You know, like because of the risible horror of the Trump years, the people of the United States and of the developed nations of the world resolved to do such and such, in which case, in a strange, roundabout, and unpleasant way, we would owe him a debt of gratitude.
Yeah. Well, that's optimism. That's that truly is optimism, Ford.
Which I owe to music.
There you there you go. Bring it around. Did you do that Bob Mould show yet? Are you
Bob Mould? I get to play with him next Sunday.
Oh man.
Today is Bob Mould's 57th birthday, I happen to know.
Happy birthday, Bob Mould.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've always been a big fan. It's just
same.
How do you feel do you get a little starstruck when you meet people like who possibly would be your star, you know, your heroes?
Yeah, sometimes I do. Sometimes I do. It still happens a little bit. I mean, not much, because I'm not a kid. But no, Bob Mould is a big one for me, and I'm looking forward to that. I've had, you know, I've been privileged. I've had some real brushes with some heroes.
Yeah.
And the, you know, I think that some of my best friends in real life happen to be members of what I consider to be the two best bands in the world, you know, so,
yeah.
and others as well. So I've been lucky in that regard, but yeah, I'm looking forward to playing with him. And one of the things that I'm looking most forward to about it, as a matter of fact, is that, when, I was contacted, I got the gig, like, okay, well that'll be fun. And then I started putting together a set list. It's like, oh, geez, I'm going to have to like sort of go out of my way to not play any stuff that sounds like shitty Bob Mould. Because I'm doing it solo.
Yeah.
He's playing solo. And, you know, so, okay, well, here's a couple of white fellas playing all these big chimey chords down at the bottom of the neck through loud amplifiers.
Yeah.
Except that he has been doing it better for longer, so I'm gonna have to like kind of go out of my way to mine the catalog for a set which doesn't share too much DNA with, you know, the New Day Rising record.
Well, it's tough because that's a big, obviously big influence that and like,
yeah,
you know, and it's funny, if you were Bob Mould and you're listening to other people play music, you could hear yourself in that. That's kind of, I mean, that must be neat. I mean, that's an interesting thing to think about, where people emulate kind of what you do. I've never seen that, you know, in other things. I've always been the emulator. I've never been the one that sort of creates and, you know,
he's being emulated.
Yeah, he's the true innovator of like, oh, just honest lyrics and driving music, and yeah, he's a force.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. But there's an animating impulse there, which makes the original so vital, and makes anything which proceeds from it come up short unless it finds something very special of its own to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I've been on tour with No Means No in Europe before, where they had an enormous influence for several years there. And, you know, every band that would be opening up for them for a little while there would be this like sort of pseudo math type of metal math. Just like another one, seriously. But you know, like so many people have never have so many worked so hard at music of such little ability to connect with people. And the reason is there's no hooks.
Yeah.
No Means No has great choruses.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
They have these wonderful, snappy, those guys, like, they listen to Squeeze and Elvis Costello and stuff, you know, the hardcore energy and the difficulty and the brah of it is very impressive and everything. But what a lot of people who were moved to try and reproduce that music themselves is like, well, there's no, you know, like cool, like sort of hook here thing, you know, there's no like little thing that sounds like it comes out of a Ramones song.
Yeah. Yeah. No Means No has a special space in my heart too. Like, especially Wrong, like that record is just so unbelievably good. And I remember there was a time where bands came out of Victoria kind of sounding like that Wrong record. Does that make sense? Like there was
a little bit of that. Yeah.
It had its own sound and everything.
I think I know a couple of the bands that you're talking about, but even those bands, because Victoria was small enough that you'd get laughed out of court if that's all you had to offer. I mean, I think that to places outside of Victoria than a group like Shovelhead or a group like Pigment Vehicle, because, you know, they had mathy inclinations or because they were like kind of spazzy and uncool seeming, might have seemed a little like No Means No, but really they were just drinking the same water, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, No Means No is a band I think that definitely was left underrated when it came to when the 90s took over, you know what I mean? Like the 90s, like I always thought most badass tour would be Primus and No Means No on tour together. They would just be so complimentary of each other. You know, for some reason I thought that would be such a great tour.
I'm sure that No Means No would have been very happy to be on that tour because it probably would have netted them like some money.
Yeah, or just recognition, you know what I mean? Because you look, you know,
yeah,
you know, that's
important. I won't speak for those guys, but they, you know, they had opportunities to get on that train, and they were always just like,
yeah,
whatever.
That's a West Coast. They don't want to make it.
Well, no, I don't think that it's that. I mean, you could, there's plenty of other examples.
Yeah, yeah. Anti-stardom, you know, and that's sort of a, I mean, that was a thing.
Or not,
you know,
even anti-stardom, but just like, okay, how many more people are we going to bring on board if we mobilize platoons of publicists and radio people and, you know, like try and convince people that they like this music? They'll get into it for a little while and then their connection to it is so tenuous that 90% of them are going to leave for something else when this is no longer hip.
Yeah.
And, you know, why would you do that anyway? You're making a decent living and you keep everything you make.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like people like No Means No or like Shellac or like Fugazi are in a much better situation financially once all the dust has settled than a lot of their contemporaries who went after the brass ring. And it broke up bands that we know.
Yeah.
You know, that pressure to perform commercially and that disappointment in not having done so.
Well, it's such a big gamble because you try to make a record that is commercial, or you say a record that's probably in vain of what the scene could be or what you think is popular. Yeah. Or, you know, like Nirvana is the classic example of it. But there's bands like Sam I Am who put out amazing records and had that chance to sort of push it just one level up, but they were very loyal to their fans that they felt that trying to push it in the radio and trying to be rock stars was just didn't serve the purpose of the people that brought them into that situation. So that it's a tricky situation. You either And it, you always feel like, it, I guess, you know, I've worked with bands that sort of left their old fans behind, and it doesn't feel good for them. But
no.
The bank looks better, you know what I mean? The bank accounts are, you know, and everybody's getting paid. But at what cost?
Very, very few bands are able to survive that. I think, you know, maybe Sonic Youth came out of a mainstream interface with their balls intact.
Pixies.
That's another good example. But another thing about them is that I happen to know that they were shrewd early on, and they were Black Francis or Frank Black or Charles Cobblepot or whatever. they didn't know what they had on their hands when they first emerged, because they were a new type and everything. And so he met absolutely no resistance when he insisted for their first major label distributed release that he retain full ownership and control of his publishing. So that's not ordinarily something that you get away with when there's millions of dollars being gambled on your ability to set the world on fire.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting, I mean, when the early 2000s hit and people had interesting ways of trying to make a famous band famous, or a band famous, that a lot of it was, you pay for everything and we'll let you keep everything and we'll see what happens. And and there was a time earlier before them where they're just giving out millions of dollars for a ton of records to come out over the period of 10 years. And people got bit in the ass, you know, like nobody was, people were breaking up, you know, and they're getting these what were quote unquote $1 million record deals, but not really delivering. So I think the bands that really came out of it were the bands that sort of paid for everything themselves and
oh yeah,
and
totally,
and took it upon like their own business. Like a band like Propagandhi, they just have now come out on top with this brand new record. It's fucking amazing. But you know, and they paid the whole thing, and it's, you know, and now they're reaping the rewards. And a lot of them, like band like that, it's all timing. Like they knew when to do it, or they didn't.
Well, but, yeah, and also, know. I mean, like that when they just got in the van. I mean, like even before what's the first one? How to Clean Everything?
Yeah,
or whatever. Yeah. They spent 2 years just like driving around playing shows.
Yeah, there's an interesting story actually, because Chris, John Sutton was their sound guy on that first tour, and he's the Weaker Than's bass player for a while.
Yeah.
And he would tell me stories that they did the first half of the tour of that record, and it was sort of like nobody showed up, and then all of a sudden people just started showing up. Like it was like this weird phenomenon, and this is pre-internet and pre-everything, where it was like, you know, it became a thing, you know, and... You know, and that band has grown so huge, just as bands, as musicians, you know.
And that part is ineluctably a young man's game, because I mean, like I think that it the opportunity still exists for bands that are serious and not careerist, but who are, you know, committed to what they do and who treat each other with respect and who, you know, see the band as being, you know, their life's work or whatever. If you get into a van and drive around for 3 years, then you will. And you're any good, you got to be a good band. Mm-hmm. But if you just like go, then, you know, you will wind up with some kind of an audience.
Yeah. It's the commitment that people want to see, and
people wait around, you know, like to, you know, the people are aware. I work at a record store, and it seems to me as though the mainstreaming of information about release dates and labels and all of these weird things that I, you know, like was only sort of vaguely aware of when I was growing up being a music fan, everybody is keenly aware of them. And people, when they start their own bands, respond to those sorts of things. It's like, okay, well, this is when the YouTube video is going to be unleashed, and this is when, not everybody, but more people than should care about this do. And all it seems like to me is just like a waste of time. Like, you know, get book the shows, get in the van, come home, relax for a couple of weeks, and then get in the van and go off and do it again. And if you have that sort of commitment, then the reward of an audience awaits you inevitably.
Mm-hmm. How do you think Canada is embracing touring musicians these days?
It's better in a lot of ways. There's a whole lot more shows in smaller places than there used to be. Western Canada used to be like a hellish ordeal of like 5 dates, mm-hmm. Separated by 10 to 17 hour drives. You know, now there's way more places to play.
Yeah. What do you attribute that to? Like social media?
Yes, I think that's a big part of it. Also, the infiltration of the sensibility of underground or independent culture to a broader base, because you don't have to. You used to have to be in a in an urban center in order to hear about this stuff, eh?
Yeah.
You had no hope of hearing of, you know, like, I don't know, 3 Day Stubble or the Oil Tasters or anything like that. If you lived in Camrose, you would have to be around people who shared your enthusiasms, and there would be enough of you that made it economically viable for an independent record store to bring in zines, which brought you more information about that stuff. You weren't going to hear about it on television, but you might hear about it on a community radio station if there were a couple of dedicated DJs who spent a whole lot of their own money on imports, stuff like that. It was hard information to come by in parts of Canada once upon a time when you and I were getting into it, let's say. Now it's easy. And somebody who just happens to like this music is like, hey, this is the music that I've been waiting for my whole life. Where have you been? I don't want to listen to all this new country music about trucks. I want to hear.
Yeah.
Gal Grayson. I want to hear. I want to hear the new Weaves record or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It's easier for them to access that and to settle on that as being the rabbit that they're going to run after.
Yeah, I remember there was a time, and maybe it was just me, but where when I went and searched music, I went and found the weirdest music I could find, and it was always good, like van music, where like Babe the Blue Ox or something, and it was like music that would just make people feel weird, and. I searched that out, and I accidentally saw them like live, and I thought, this is my favorite band ever. I don't know why. I love this band. But it would always sort of make people, and then I would take that CD or cassette that I had and take it to other on different tours, and that was sort of, to me, how music got distributed, you know, because it was a captive audience. You're in a van, you can listen to this and check this out, you know, it would be really nice in a perfect utopian world to say that, you know, I am into, you know, and Spotify kind of does this a little bit where you're like, I'm into this music. And it's like, well, check these other bands out, you know, even though nobody's making any money off it. But you know what I'm trying to say, right? That there just needs to be a little bit more closer connection to what is interesting to that person. You know, I think there's still a bit of a disconnect when it comes to.
Yeah, it's, I mean, like Spotify ideally should operate exactly the way that you're talking about, except that there's this info sedative quality of it, just because it's totally uncurated.
Yeah.
If somebody gives you a mix cassette of their favorite stuff, and it's somebody who's a friend, or you trust their taste, or you envy their access to mm-hmm. things or whatever, then you're going to listen to that cassette. You're going to take it seriously, and you aren't going to enjoy all of it probably, but it's going to give you a couple of things to go off of. But, you know, like, this is, you know, why the content regurgitator entertainment periodicals have a little bit more power now than they really ought to have. And it's, you know, I mean, even that is not all that much.
Yeah.
The turnover for all of this is so swift, and if you blink, you'll miss it. Yeah. It's like, here's what's happening now. Here's a new thing. And so if you don't act on that, if you don't acquire that music, if you don't hear it, then it's going to get lost. It's going to get buried, like, you know, like in your email inbox.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I was sort of beginning to lose my train of thought there.
Well, I always find that, that if you're in a trend, and the trend, if you miss out on a couple of steps of the trend, you're left behind. You know what I mean? Like, there's a few satellite radio stations I listen to, and I listen to new alternative music. I have no idea, like, what alternative music is anymore. I have no idea. And I used to, like, I used to understand kind of where it all came from. And now I have no context, no history, because I stopped listening to terrestrial radio a while ago because I thought it had nothing to offer. Mm-hmm. So all I do is listen to podcasts, and I should probably get more into music podcasts, and then maybe I can get into more actual music that makes sense to me, you know, because I feel a little lost. I mean, I think that's why we all gravitate to old music or older music that made us feel good when we were kids, you know? And, you know, I want to be able to sort of tune in, you know, because I don't, you know, you don't want to be that old guy that's like, I used to like, you know, that band. That was my favorite band.
No, but the thing is, though, the ironic thing about that is that the old guy impulse there, it seems to me, is the impulse to locate the stuff that you really enjoy. Mm. The real pioneering spirit was like Dave Bedini from Rio Statics tells a great story about, like, he knew that I don't know what radio station it was. It might have been like the really weak transmitter, like specifically in Etobicoke. Mm-hmm. But he knew that their broadcasting day repeated itself. And so earlier in the day, he'd hear something like Life is Good by Joe Walsh. So at night, he'd know that it was going to come on again. And so he'd be there with his tape recorder with a transistor radio next to it, ready to hit record when that song came on again. He was waiting for that. In the meantime, he was exposed to all sorts of other stuff which he would not have listened to otherwise.
Yeah.
And that has an effect on creating a musical sense of it. It's not all stuff that you're going to enjoy, but now you don't have to put up with a note of music, which is not exactly that's the sort of music that I like.
Yeah.
You know what I like? No, not the first or the third song on Out of Step by Minor Threat. Yeah, I want only songs that sound exactly like that. That BPM and the, what is the third song on Out of Step? It's like the Think Again, or how did I come up with that? You got my brain going here, Simon. So yeah, I want only songs that sound exactly like that. And there is probably, you know, there might very likely be a playlist out there which is constructed around that key, those beats per minute, those sentiments or whatever, and that's all that person ever has to listen to. They have a completely vertical aesthetic experience for the rest of their life.
Which is dangerous.
And they never have to be exposed to anything which might broaden their interests or help them grow in other ways ever again.
Yeah, I think you've touched on something that I agree with you, that the bar of what we consider good is kind of, it's high, but at the same time, there's no understanding of where the low part is, you know, like, what sucks? You know, I want to know what sucks so I can understand what's good. And there used to be albums that I'd listen to where, like, there's a couple of songs on here that I know suck, but I got to get through it because I don't want to fast forward that cassette. I'm just going to listen to it. I'm going to put up with it. And then I'm going to get the good song that I like. And we don't anymore. We don't have that. We don't have that because we can easily, like you say, just flip over and find, or look in our phone and find out the song we like. And that's
sure.
And that's dangerous. I mean, we need to have an understanding and perspective what is good and bad. Otherwise, it's all either good or it's all either bad.
That's right. And even worse is that all of that provides the illusion that we have some kind of a choice about all of this, because we've just chosen all the things that we already know that we like. And that's not any sort of a choice, because there's no alternative to it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, I mean, I'm not the type of person to go buy a record player. Like, I have records in here in this house somewhere, you know, they're old Pink Floyd records mostly, but I understand that, you know, we are all in a modern time and we should get it, but we need to bring some of that old shit back, you know, because, and we, it's these conversations like this that sort of understand, like, the younger people listen to the show and it's like, this is important to us, you know, and sometimes that gets missed out, you know, and
yeah.
But, well, hey, I mean, honestly, I was really impressed that, like, how did you manage to, like, get to play at Massey Hall with Rio Statics? That's an important question I've been thinking about all night.
How did I get to do it?
Yeah.
Well, I was kind of in the band at the time.
Yeah.
So that I didn't have anything to do with booking the show or anything.
No. I mean, like, how? So obviously, the Dave and the Rio Statics are fans of you and your music and you as a person. Like, how did you find your way sort of into that? Because Rio Statics are one of my favorite bands on earth. And, you know,
The way that it happened is that I had known them for a long time, each of them individually, and been a fan of the band and. Had played with them, and I don't know. The Rio Statics are, you know, like just such a circus, and they always want to include all of their friends and everything. And so they invite you up to like sing Land Ho on Northern Wish, or they hand you an instrument, you know, like do a solo so that here Tim wants to play guitar on Horses. So all of a sudden you're playing the bass or whatever. Yeah. And I think that just once I was out there, I had played keyboards with them a couple of times out here because they're always into that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And once I was living out there, and I was in Martin's solo band as well. Mm-hmm. He and I had played a lot of music together. And Michael and I, of course, had recorded together. And so once I was there, I just, well, I don't know. Was I invited? No, I think that I just like, no, I think that I just like started turning up in like Waterloo or London with an instrument. It's like, here I am. Each of them would assume that somebody else had invited me. And then I would just, you know, play along. And so that's how it was for the last year of that band, which was a gas. And so then when the Massey Hall show had been in the works for a while, and when it was determined that that would be the final show or whatever, I had actually moved back to Vancouver by that time, but I went back for that. It was.
That's an important show.
It was just a really good show. It was a weird show.
Martin lost his voice, right?
Yeah. It was, we did the show before the show at the Horseshoe, which in a lot of ways was a better show. just because the Rio Statics don't really shine, I feel, in those rarefied, embalmed situations like the soft cedar where everybody is listening very attentively and, you know, they thrive on a certain amount of chaos.
Yeah.
And, you know, like where the they have enough time so that the set list can be abandoned and they can do just like whatever they want.
Yeah.
Which is impossible when there's, you know, a production schedule like
the crew hanging out.
Yeah. All of that stuff. And so the real show was at the Horseshoe. Was it the night before or something like that? I don't know. Martin had lost his voice by that time, and it was just like kind of funny. Everybody just rolled their eyes, and he just motored through it. Mm. And at the end of the evening, we're like out in the crowd doing Legal Age Life or bread, meat, peas, and rice or something a cappella like that. And Marty's up on top of a chair, just like singing like an angel. And I'm like, fuck, this is going to have very severe consequences for the, for the big show. Yeah. But, and sure enough, it was, so I don't know. I just felt for all the people who had like flown in from all over the globe to catch the final Rio Static show because they had to put up with me singing.
Yeah.
Martin, so.
Well, I mean, my real, like I said, Rio Static's is and still will be one of my favorite bands on earth. And, I saw them at El Macambo when they did a residency there. And when they did Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, there was a moment where they just went off on this tangent where Martin was just making these crazy noises. And I've said this story a few times, but it seemed like the El Macambo upstairs, it used to be the venue was the stage was sort of on the side of the room. Yeah. Rather, so mm-hmm. I actually, for some reason, it was a full house. And for some reason I ended up like the crowd parted and I ended up right. And I wasn't high or anything. I was just like, this is the most amazing experience I will ever have at a show. And I've seen some amazing shows in my life, but there was moments where I could just see him feeling what he was playing. And I was like, this is the most special moment. And it still is to this day, one of the most special moments in music for me to understand like what people project, not just the music and the tones, but just what they project as a musician. And going into my later life, this has really inspired me, that really inspired me, So one day I will have Dave Bedini and I'll have either Martin or someone on the show because he keeps like saying, I want to do the show. And I'm like, great, let's do it tomorrow. And he's like, oh, I can't do it tomorrow.
Well, yeah. he's all busy with his broadsheet newspaper right now.
But so I keep trying. And I actually had my friend Justin Small, who plays in Do Make Say Think. And I laughingly said, if Dave Bedini did the show as many times as I asked him, it would be the Simon and Dave Bedini show, because I've asked him 150 times to be on the fucking show. And he's just so busy. So Dave, it's an open invitation. Come be on the show. I just don't like bugging him on Facebook anymore. It's like, just come and do the show or don't. It's simple.
Dave, if you're listening to this, come on in. The water's nice.
Well, I mean, I really, I'm so glad that I got to talk to you. And I was I put you on that list of people I really wanted to talk to because I knew you're an interesting enough person that just has so many stories and you've done it and you've been doing it for this many years. And
that's a nice thing.
You're very positive when it comes to your perspective of what it's about. And that's inspiring to anybody, and me too. So, thank you for doing what you do. And,
Oh, I've enjoyed talking to you. And Simon, it's been a very, very long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's not do it. Like, let's not wait 22 years again.
Yeah, for sure.
I've seen you from afar.
Hope to run into you out there sometime.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ciao.
Mr. Ford Pier. That was fun. That was fun. Thanks, Ford, for doing the show. Really appreciate that. I really appreciate everybody that comes on the show. And because they gotta, talk to a guy like me. Sometimes I talk. Sometimes they talk. That's how the show works. Thanks, everybody. Also, thanks to you for listening to the show. Don't forget about all the new beers that Bose is putting out. Well, don't forget about Lugtred. That's their regular beer. Don't forget, my favorite of it all was the Wag the Wolf. That's the beer to get. If you get that beer, you'll love it. It's delicious. I think it tastes a lot like an IPA. They do IPAs brilliantly, by the way. Any of their IPAs, get it. They're delicious. The Nordic Pale Ale or even that, it's delish. Thanks, everybody. Don't forget about Patreon. Thanks to my patrons. Thanks for supporting the show. Like I said, I'm saving up money so I can take a trip somewhere. All that patron money. Don't forget to shop on Amazon and all that stuff, okay? I got a couple of great guests coming up. I haven't recorded them yet, but I'm going to do that tomorrow. Today being Sunday. Today is Monday. That's the day that I'm going to be recording two special episodes at the same time. One after the other. And then I'll let you know in the week. Because I've been sort of lackadaisical on when new guests are coming on. I usually put a poster up, but I've been pretty lax on that. But I'm going to put one up next week. I promise.
Okay.
So everybody, next week, see you again. Bye.